And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and Michael Lauck will be joining us in a moment for the news. Today's podcast is number 63 with Philip Mantle from England. This will be the second time he's on. He is the guy who cracked the hoax of the alien autopsy film. He's going to be back talking to us about his latest book, which is a fiction. And I just wanted to let people out there know I'm going to a couple of conferences coming up. I'll be attending the Experiencers Speak. That's September 6th through the 8th. And that's in Portland, Maine. I actually live about 6 miles away from there. Also, I will be at the first New England UFO conference that will take place on Saturday, October 26th, and that's in Leominster, Massachusetts. I'm going to be at both of those. Stan Friedman and a couple of other people are going to be there. Robert Schroeder, who was our guest a week or so ago, he's going to be there. Travis Walton and Stephen Pierce. And all kinds of fun people will be at both of those. So I should get some good recordings, and it should be a lot of fun. So, Michael, how are you doing this week?
Good. How are you?
Great.
This week we have a great deal of science news and some sad news for the UFO community. Before we start, though, I'd like to remind everyone to visit us on Facebook for daily updates brought to you by Peggy. You can also visit podcastufo.com for show notes, which includes links to media coverage of all our stories, forums, and blogs. Also, while you're on your computer, please drop by iTunes and review the podcast for us. It will actually help us show up better in the search ratings.
We only have a few ratings on there at this time. I can't remember, maybe six or something like that. And we know we get a ton of people listening on iTunes, so we'd really appreciate if you do that. And speaking of participation, helping out the show, we do have a subscribe button on our sidebar. You can subscribe for as low as $5 per month to help us out. We do have some expenses, so it would be greatly appreciated. So for less than a couple of cups of coffee a month, you can help us out a lot. And I do want to thank the people who are on there now. And I also want to thank each and every listener, whether you can help us out or not. We really do appreciate you.
The non-news of the Area 51 disclosure makes the news. The recent admission by the CIA that Area 51 is real, but just tests super secret spy planes, was widely greeted as a kind of non-news event. We, of course, discussed this last week. NBC has since posted an article, complete with video, covering the recent disclosure, which includes comments from Richard Boylan, Alejandro Rojas, and Bob Lazar, the man who put Area 51 on the map.
You know, Bob Lazar has been sort of stealth-like himself, like a spy plane, for a number of years, says he won't do any more interviews, and they actually found him. What do you know about that, Michael?
Evidently, supposedly he has some kind of government contracting company is what I had recently heard.
Yes.
And, yeah, doesn't tend to do any of these interviews anymore, but I guess when NBC shows up, you comment.
Right. And he's like somewhere in the Midwest or something like that.
What's wrong with that?
You're probably in cahoots with him. I knew it. Wow. I just nailed that.
No comment.
Yeah.
But speaking of Bob Lazar, one of Lazar's claims was that Area 51 had alien devices powered by element 115, which was not found on the periodic table. Researchers claimed to create a single atom about 10 years ago, but the results were ruled inconclusive because it was only a single atom. A new team led by Dirk Rudolph at Lund University in Sweden has claimed to have created 30 atoms of element 115, and this time the results look promising. The element is incredibly unstable and remarkably short-lived, which does little to confirm Lazar's claim that the U.S. government had a 500-pound stockpile of the substance. Read more about the hunt for element 115 in the New Scientist article linked to in our show notes. It is a very readable short piece for the non-scientist.
Yeah, I guess they call it, what, unobtainium or something like that also?
No, that is, I don't know. Maybe somebody calls them that. I have heard that before. This one actually has a long and, for me, unpronounceable name that translates to basically being 115. So it doesn't have an official name yet until it gets officially turned into an element. And then I think all bets are off. I don't know how the naming process works. Perhaps Rudolph and his team get to name it.
Well, Let's pick on Bob Lazar a little bit more. Because, okay. You know, first of all, 500 pounds compared to 30 atoms. Do you know what 30 atoms is?
You know, it lasted like fractions of a second.
I mean, if you talk about atoms, what is it? One glass of water has more atoms in it than all the glasses of water in all the oceans of the world or something like that. I mean, it's just so hard to fathom. It's so minute. And they're talking only 30 atoms were made of this. I guess it is proof that something was made, though, right?
Yes, actually, I mean, that's part of the problem, if you read the article, is that at no point can you kind of point to it and say, hey, look, there's a pile of element 115. Because even those 30 atoms are there so quickly, they basically only measure their existence by the refuse their breakdown leaves behind.
Yeah. I had a girlfriend like that once. Yeah. Sorry.
I think that's a different podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
There are those who believe that life here began out there. Biochemist Steven Brenner of the Westheimer Institute for Science and Technology believes that his research shows that life on Earth was seeded by meteorites from Mars. He makes the argument that 3 billion years ago, Mars was more suited to the development of life than Earth, which was low on atmospheric oxygen and high on water, which was damaging to the many building blocks required for early life. You can read more about it through the article in our show notes.
There's no proof yet that there was actually life on Mars for sure, but
there's the face.
There's the face, yeah. And, you know, there probably was. Mars probably had a magnetosphere at one time that probably held the atmosphere and water in. And, you know, I mean, there's definite signs of millions or billions of years and of water flow. And when a magnetosphere goes, all the atmosphere and the water goes. And don't you think for a minute it can't happen to Earth? It could.
That's right. That's why we need to colonize everywhere we can.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, quick pop quiz. That headline. Do you know what that headline was from?
No.
Those were the opening lines of the original Battlestar Galactica narration.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Speaking of...
It's a nerdy week.
All right. That's awesome. Speaking of pop quiz, on that particular link, there is a 10-question quiz on that that's about Mars. What do you know about Mars quiz on that? And I got 7 out of 10, which really is bad.
It's a C.
Yeah.
It's not bad.
I always was a C student.
You're passing.
Yeah.
All right. Wormholes are the key to time travel. Astrophysicist Eric W. Davis has authored a new paper arguing that wormholes are the key ingredient to time travel and faster than light travel. Of course, science has yet to actually prove the existence of wormholes. So making the case for time travel by wormhole is about as practical at this point as penning a paper pointing out that all you need for practical time travel is to make friends with a benevolent renegade time lord with a soft spot for the UK. Read more about it, though, in the Life Science article we've linked to in our show notes.
I was reading that article, and physicists have actually, in fact, sent muons, which is a little tiny particle, into the future. Did you actually know that? They've actually done time travel?
There is a little bit of controversy about it. But sending things to the future is not really practically a problem when you think about it. I mean, we're all moving into the future. It's getting back.
Yeah.
Getting back that makes it. Or moving back to affect the difference. I mean, to move things in the future, nah. Time bombs, theoretically, philosophically affect the future.
Wow.
It's not nearly as impressive as moving back and forth.
I just can't wrap my head around all this stuff.
You know, I think I've plugged this before, and I'll plug it again. If anybody does want to wrap their head around some of the science a little better, there is no better way to kind of grasp the basics of physics than getting a hold of the Richard Feynman lectures, which there are complete sets that are fairly expensive. But you can get a paperback book with a CD of lectures for the core elements of classical mechanics called 5 Easy Pieces, and the core elements of classical kind of, well, classical's a word, but the basis of more of your astrophysics and your relativity in a book called 6 Not So Easy Pieces. But they're just a great introduction from probably the best physics lecturer ever in America.
Yeah. You getting a commission on that?
No, I'm not. In fact, I'm not even sure that anybody makes money off that anymore. It was done as a project just to preserve his teaching at one point, like 50 years ago. Hmm. And they're great stuff. I'm a big Feynman fan.
Yeah.
Doesn't everyone have a favorite physicist?
No. No.
Next, hey, you're going to tell me you don't have a favorite economist.
No. Now, getting back to this article, though, wormholes, you know, a very, very interesting theory, but they really don't know for sure if they actually exist, you know? And if they do, they think they might be extremely small, smaller than a person could fit through. I mean, they have no idea exactly.
Right, exactly. Think like event center of a black hole, small, tiny. But it doesn't necessarily matter. Because just because it's tiny doesn't mean it can't be put to practical use if it did and does exist. If nothing else, it might be the means to future communication for long-distance colonies or other civilizations.
Fascinating. I mean,
think about that, SETI. What if everybody's talking through the wormholes that we can't even prove exist?
Yeah, there you go.
And finally, a bit of sad news. Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr. has passed away at the age of 76. Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., famous as the son of Major Jesse Marcel, passed away this week of an apparent heart attack. Dr. Marcel maintained that not only was the Roswell UFO crash a reality, but his father brought home some debris. It was Marcel who described the purplish I-beams with strange symbols and the foil that would pop back into shape after being folded. As an adult, Jesse Marcel Jr. became a medical doctor, serving in the Navy and the Montana Army National Guard, and he even served a year as a flight surgeon in Iraq back in 2004. We'll cover this more in our blogs this week, and I'm sure you have some comments, Martin.
Yeah, I'm glad you're writing a blog. Thanks for doing that. Yeah, I was in a remote area this last week, and Robert Hastings sent me an email telling me about the passing of Jesse. I was shocked. I had asked someone recently, actually, for his contact info. I was going to try to get him on the show. Great guy. I think he was a solid person, and he actually stood up and told the truth about what he knew, even, you know, putting his medical career on the line by speaking about that.
Well, not only his medical career, his military career.
Right, yeah.
You know, he was in the Guard for all the time and then got called back to service in 2004 when he would have been like 66, 67 years old, which that on its own is something incredible to think about.
Yeah, that is something. Well, I don't want to go out on such a sad note. And speaking of medical careers and all that, this gives me a great opportunity to pick on Dr. Stephen Greer again. Are you ready for this one, Michael?
Yes. You know, he's going to send his bodyguard after you.
I know. It's going to happen sooner or later. Well, you know, he gave up his practice to find baby aliens and channel overflying ETs and all that stuff. Well, recently, while he was in Australia, some of the Aussie witnesses reported hanging with him whilst he was channeling these ETs and aliens. And they said that he was doing this channeling in a real low voice using a French accent. What do you think about that, Michael?
Well, I think the Zeta Reticuli accent is often mistaken for a Parisian dialect.
Is that what it is? I was thinking maybe he watched a little too much of Saturday Night Live with the Coneheads. They always said they were from France.
They were from France, exactly.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I don't know. But anyway, thanks so much. You know, we went really long this time. We had a long news session.
All right, thank you, and I will talk to you again next week.
See you then. Yeah. I'm on Skype with Philip. How are you, Philip?
I'm fine, thank you very much, Martin. A little bit warm here in England, but I'm absolutely hunky-dory.
All right. Well, it's great to have you back on. I really enjoyed our last talk. I believe it was probably over a year ago. But now you have a book that you're just launching here. Can you talk about that? It's a fiction, first of all.
That's right, Martin. You know, in the past, I've written or co-authored a number of non-fiction books. So this is my first attempt at a work of fiction. It's staying in the same subject matter of you know, UFOs. Haven't strayed away from that. But it's an alien abduction novel. The title is called Once Upon a Missing Time. And it's based in the UK back in the 1990s. And, it's literally come out just a few days ago as we speak.
Now, it's out on Richard Dolan Press. I didn't even know there was such a thing, actually.
Yeah, well, Richard started off, I believe, self-publishing his own material, his own books, and looked at publishing as a way of earning a living, because a lot of authors in this field, Martin, they find it difficult to be accepted by, in inverted commas, the conventional publishers. It's been very difficult for a lot of us down the years. Mm-hmm. So Richard knows the marketplace. Knows a lot of the people personally. I mean, I've met Richard, so he decided to set up his own small publishing company. It's only got a small stable of authors at the moment, but it is expanding. And I'm very grateful to him, and it looks like he's doing well, and I'm very pleased for him.
Well, first of all, I want to say I love the title to the book. That's really catchy. That's really a fun title. And can you basically talk about the synopsis of the book?
Absolutely, Martin. I mean, the title is a play on words. I mean, the sort of phrase missing time is synonymous with the alien abductions, the close encounters. So it's an expansion of that, really. Now, my first work of nonfiction was published back in 1994. And that was a book called Without Consent. And that book was all about, alien abduction accounts and missing time cases, purely from here in the United Kingdom, nowhere else, just here in the UK. And I still have all the files. I mean, this was pre-internet days, no email and things of that nature when I did all this research. And at the time, I travelled the length and breadth of the UK, interviewing people face-to-face, also obtaining, historical files, cases from the 1950s and so on. And that turned into the non-fiction book Without Consent. Now, at that time, there was still, and probably still is, Martin, a lot of ridicule attached to the subject, stigma. But I found in the 90s that started to change a little bit. I think, people getting involved like the late Dr. John Mack and even now Nick Pope from the Ministry of Defence, and TV shows like The X-Files, I think they helped, popularise and give the subject matter an air of credibility, if you like. And so the idea was in my head, for whatever reason, to write a book of fiction, but based in fact, Martin, drawing on all the interviews I'd done, drawing all the files that I have, literally sat next to me here in my filing cabinet, and all the people in it, the UFO researchers, and so on, are all based on real people. Sadly, one or two of them are no longer with us. But same with the abductees. It's not based on any one particular account. It's more of an amalgamation of all these people I interviewed. For example, it's quite an emotional book. There's a lot of, angst and trauma in it, if you like. And that's based on a lady that I interviewed many times. She's called Rosalind Reynolds. People have never have heard of Rosalind. She's not on the lecture circuit or anything like that. She lives in Lincolnshire here in the UK. But, she talked about the feeling of helplessness. Who do you turn to when this kind of things happen? I mean, literally, who do you go to? Hmm. And so I turned all this into a fictional family. It's the Morrisons. It's a man and his wife. They live in a small rural setting here in the county where I live, in Yorkshire, although the north part of it. They have a young daughter, 13-year-old. You know, Alan Morrison is a teacher at the local high school. He's a good teacher, but as hard as he can, he can't fit into the teaching profession. His wife, Pamela, is a social worker. You know, they're both overworked, underpaid, highly stressed as it is when this close encounter happens. So whilst we look at what happens to them and the way it unfolds, the main theme of the book is how they try and deal with it. Who do you turn to? How do you cope with such an experience? And the stresses and strains it causes in their already fraught relationship. I mean, for example, Martin, I spoke to many people, and I said, well, why have you come to me with the, you know, this account? And they said, well, Philip, you know, I first told my family, they didn't know what to do. I went to my doctor, he prescribed me pills. So who do I turn to? And this is also reflected in the storyline of the book. And that's how, you know, they first go to their family, end up, you know, sort of kind of reluctantly speaking to the UFO research community. And, you know, and it unfolds, you know, as the story goes along. And so it is based on factual accounts, but it's nonetheless a fictional story. And we also try and emphasise, Martin, again, this was borne out by my research, that whatever the abduction phenomenon is, and I don't pretend to have the answers, this book doesn't provide any answers. It is completely random. It happens to people in all walks of life, you know, all over the world, any place, anywhere. Despite what the sceptics might have us believe, that it's some lunatic running around the hills somewhere, that it only happens to in the middle of nowhere, that is not true. And most, if not all, of the abductees are as bewildered as the rest of us as to what has happened, you know. And I try and paint that picture in Once Upon a Missing Time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was reading a little bit about this book, and I imagine that it really can tear people apart, their families apart. Have you seen a lot of that in your research?
Absolutely. Again, I mentioned a lady there called Rosalind. I mean, put a great strain on her relationship at the time, and the relationship, you know, finally came to an end. So from an experiences point of view, yes, it can have a tremendous effect on their family life, their everyday life, their work life, you know.
Right.
And I also found from my own experience as a UFO researcher, that from a researcher's point of view, it can also have an effect on your family life and your work life. You may not always realize that that's happening. You become, you know, so deeply involved in this subject that, you know, before you know it, Martin, it has an effect. And that happened to me personally, you know, so that's not speaking in the third person. I know that from first-hand experience. But, you know, no two abductees and no two accounts are the same. They all deal with it in their own way. Some people look at it as a very positive experience, you know, but it can cause an awful lot of confusion. Again, there's one lady who's not mentioned in the book by name. And in my original book, Without Consent, she's named, but I give her a different name. And she had a lifetime of experiences, Martin. And, you know, her first instance was to go and tell her family.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what to do. I mean, so they sent her to the doctor. And this was a period in England when if a housewife went to the doctor complaining of certain ailments, they were given tranquilizers, you know, no matter what. And that's what she was given. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it didn't do any good at all. So she threw them in the bin. And then just quite by chance, she saw, you know, my name in a local newspaper article and contacted me. But these things had already been ongoing for a number of years. And she was just happy. I use that word kind of loosely. She was pleased that she just had somebody that would sit down and listen without ridicule, without laughing, without passing judgment. And, you know, a lot of the abductees, certainly back then, found that of a great help. And some of them set up their own support groups, and some of those are still going to this day. So it has all kinds of effects, Martin. But and some of those are outlined in the book. Couldn't put everything in there. Because, again, you know, no two people react the same way. But we try to emphasize exactly, you know, what can happen in some circumstances.
Earlier off mic, we were talking about how much work writing a book is. And, you know, especially when you're trying to do, you know, the other part of your life, like a job or something like that. And So I'm in the antiques and arts field, and a few people have crossed over that have found my name on this podcast. And one of them actually has an abduction account they want to talk to me about. I'm pretty interested in talking about that. It seems to me that there's a lot more accounts of abductions in the United States than about anywhere else. Is there quite a bit going on in the UK?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment, Martin. I think, again, you know, we forget that the United States and Britain are foreign countries. We may share a common language, mm-hmm. but our culture is very, very different indeed. You know, I think in general, the Brits are a more reserved race, if you want to use that word. And, you know, they tend to keep things closer to the chest than perhaps they do in the United States. That's been my experience anyway. I know it's a generalization, mm-hmm. but like I said, when I started my abduction research back in the late 1980s, I could think of, you know, maybe a couple of handful of known abductees here in the UK, things that had already been talked about and few that had been published. There wasn't by any means a lot. But as the 80s and the 90s progressed, and like people like John Mack and Nick Pope went into the public domain, I think it helped bring people, you know, forward. Books like Communion also helped, and other publications. So I just think it's because our cultures are quite different, Martin. But now it's a common subject here. More people are willing to go on the record. But it's still a stigma in certain circles. There is still fear and ridicule, but I don't think that's any way as bad as it used to be. You know, by writing books like this, it shows, I think, the subject matter in the right vein. I know it's a work of fiction, but it shows these were just ordinary people about their working life when this most bizarre experiences happened to them. They don't know what it was. They're looking for answers themselves. And that's often the case. You know, if you speak to many abductees, Martin, they'll say, well, you know, I was out walking my dog. You know, I was driving to work. I was, you know, picking the kids up from school or whatever it was when this thing happened. And they're looking to people like us for answers. They may have already been elsewhere to try and figure it out. Some people prefer to keep their names to themselves, which is fine. There's no problem with that. While others think that it's important that they should speak out, and I've come across that several kinds, you know, they know that there could be a little bit of ridicule, you know, a bit of, you know, people making fun of them, that kind of thing. But for whatever reason, they think, no, this is important. You know, I'm not saying I've been abducted by aliens. I'm just saying this most bizarre thing happened to me. And the only way we're ever going to find out what it is by talking about it in the open, you know, speaking to others who have had similar experiences. And maybe, you know, I have one of the answers to the puzzle. Maybe I don't, you know, but so I think it's changed down the years. And I think, you know, things like the internet and various TV shows and movies have helped. You know, like when I started in this field, there was no internet. It just did not exist. Certainly no Skype and home computers, Martin. Mm. You know, I mean, it was on the phone and in the car and you know, a letter and things of that nature. So that's why I set the book in 1990. It was a time of change here in Britain in 1990. Mrs. Thatcher had just left office. I think people around the world know who Mrs. Thatcher was. She'd just been replaced by John Major. So it was a time of change here in Britain as well. So it just kind of fit. It was a much simpler age, you know. There wasn't no digital television. We still had video cameras, you know, cassette tape recorders. The digital age wasn't upon us. There was no digital cameras. And I set it in that context. You know, it was a simpler time. I know it's not too simple. It was still a modern era. But again, the place, although it's a fictional village that I set it in North Yorkshire, there was an area in that particular region of North Yorkshire that we have the Yorkshire Dales National Park. For any of your listeners, come on over. It's a beautiful place. But we had all kinds of UFO sightings there. I mean, we were absolutely inundated with them, including, you know, the close encounter type scenarios as well. So whilst it's a fictional village name, I have set it in an area that, that had this kind of activity going on at that time. So it, it kind of fits there as well.
Now, you said that for the most part, England has kind of loosened up and it's not so conservative on the subject as it used to be. Have you noticed people coming forward that have been suppressing this for many years?
Absolutely. I mean, they said, you know, even just recently, not about just abductions, but about certain types of UFO sightings in general. They say, you know, I've never spoken to anybody about this. And there may, it may be just one thing that they read or they see somewhere that, that, that acts as a trigger. And they think, well, now's the time I should tell somebody. Mm-hmm. And you find that in many, many cases, that even some of the well-known cases like Roswell, for example, Martin, you know, there's still, you know, elderly gentlemen who are maybe former military, you know, 60, 70 years later come forward and say, well, I've never really told anybody about this. Mm-hmm. And but they made just something that that lights the touch paper, and then they think, well, you know, it's, now is the time. You know, it may be a newspaper article, it may be a TV documentary, and they think, well, I didn't really know an awful lot about this. I thought I was the only one, and but now I know I'm not, and they speak up. And, you know, we try and encourage that without going over the top. If they want to remain, you know, incognito, that's fine. There's no problem with that at all. So that happens fairly regularly. However, you also have the other side of the coin, Martin, and people will say, well, yeah, put my name on the record. I don't know what this was. I know what it wasn't. And that's people from all walks of life, and including professional people, and they said, well, I don't care, this is important, and people should know about this. And, you know, so we get quite a mixture, but, you know, people do keep it to themselves, Martin, yes.
I can only imagine what an experience would be like, and I would just feel as though I was going crazy. I can't imagine feeling any other way about that. Is that like a common theme when people come forward?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the ladies who I interviewed many, many times, a lady called Jane. Jane was a housewife with a young child. And she had a number of encounters, Martin. It wasn't just a one-off, from the age of 16 onwards. And she said, and her first reaction was, I must be going nuts. I really must be. She knew nothing about the subject. You know, she was just an ordinary woman in an ordinary village. And, you know, she thought, I must be going off my head. I really must. So she went to the doctors. And, you know, she wasn't mad. She wasn't suffering from delusion. Jumping forward in time, you know, it was about 7 years later when I first met Jane. And the encounters were still ongoing. And we talked about it. We recorded as many, much of the information as we could. And I took her to see a psychologist who was very interested in the abduction subject. And I left Jane and this particular doctor together for several hours. We had a long chat. It was all prearranged. Jane was, you know, very cooperative. And he came back and he said, well, Philip, you know, I don't know what's happened to this young lady, but I know for certain she's not delusional, she's not psychotic, she's not schizophrenic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, he gave her a clean bill of mental health. And he was shortly coming up for retirement, worked at a huge university here in the north of England, and he wanted to get involved more once he'd retired. He didn't mind putting his name to it, but sadly, you know, when he retired, he took ill and wasn't able to fulfil that. So, you know, she literally thought she was going off her head. But the doctor in question reassured her and said, well, I don't know what's happening to you, but you're not going out of your mind. You're not mad. So on one hand, she was pleased with that. But on the other hand, she thought, well, it would have been an explanation if I hadn't been mad. So right. I don't know which explanation she was happiest with, but it kind of reassured her in a way. But it is a theme that crops up now and again.
I would imagine so. And I think this is one of the reasons that drew Dr. Mack into this whole thing, is that he was finding out that these people weren't crazy. And, you know, that just made him dig deeper and deeper.
Well, absolutely, Martin. I mean, I met John Mack, you know, several times, and he read my first book without consent, and we had a few conversations when we met up, and you know, the skeptics again, or certain skeptics, would have us believe that these people are all, you know, fruitcakes, or they're looking to earn a quick buck, or they want some kind of attention seeking. And let's be honest, there are one or two like that, but there are one or two like that in, you know, circles that collect stamps, you know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in all fields. You know, this field is no different from that. But by and large, these are your everyday, ordinary member of the public. They're going about their daily tasks. They have little or no interest in this subject beforehand, and it comes to them like a bolt out of the blue. And the, you know, think about it yourself, Martin. If you knew nothing about this subject, and a lot of them don't, apart from maybe a passing bit of this and a bit of that, and this kind of thing happens, what do you do? Who do you turn to? You know, right. There isn't a department you can go and ring. And if you break your leg, you go to the ER. Mm-hmm. You know, there isn't an alien abduction ER you can go to. You know, there isn't any one central place. Who do you turn to? And again, I use that theme in Once Upon a Missing Time. The wife, Pamela, her father is a retired police officer. So, you know, they tell him, but he thinks he's seen just about everything in his time as a police officer, but he never heard of this before, and he just finds it a joke. Mm-hmm. So it was of no use to him, to them whatsoever, to speak to him about it. And I can understand that in some instances, and I really can. I mean, again, you know, you put yourself in his shoes, I can understand it. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I can understand certain people's reactions. It is a bizarre subject in its own right. But I think it's one that's gained a little bit of credence and credibility with more and more you know, professional people becoming involved, both out in the open and behind the scenes. And again, you know, that's emphasised in the book. We have a doctor who becomes involved. He's a psychologist. He's quite sceptical, but nonetheless, he becomes involved and, you know, tries to assist. It's not particularly based on Dr. Mack or anyone like that. It's again, an amalgamation of many different people. But there are people like that out there that are willing to help, not just the genuine UFO researcher. There are professionals as well.
That will actually take it seriously?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, the doctor with whom I was going to work with here in the UK took it very seriously. He was open-minded. He didn't have any opinions one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And he found it extremely intriguing. He was interested in the paranormal in general. And you know, when I spoke to Jane at length and found out she, you know, no disrespect to Jane, she wasn't a particularly hugely intelligent woman. She wasn't stupid. She was just an average lady, you know, was not into the UFO literature at all. And not only that, what was intriguing about some of the things that Jane told us, she was talking about what we might call phantom pregnancies. But not with a husband, with these otherworldly beings. And that was pretty much unknown at the time. The only chap writing about it at the time was the late Bud Hopkins in New York. And you could only read it in one or two publications. Bud hadn't, you know, published his books with this in at the time. He called them the Smart Baby Dreams. Mm-hmm. And I communicated with Bud. I knew him quite well. I sent him transcripts of my interviews with Jane, and he would come back with suggestions for other sort of questions. So how could this, you know, this housewife here in the UK repeat the same kind of things that was coming to Bud from abductees in the US when she hadn't read it? It wasn't on the TV, you know. So, again, it was intriguing. It was very intriguing. And, you know, a lot of Jane's experience has never been published. It's still sat in a file here with me. I published some of it. And, you know, she features in part in the book as well, in little bits and pieces. So, you know, even if you're a skeptic, Martin, it's still an intriguing, puzzling subject, I have to be honest.
Absolutely. And I know you're rather cautious of naming what exactly is going on in these abductions, but if you had to guess, what would your guess be?
I couldn't guess, Martin. I honestly couldn't guess. I'll give you the reason why. Again, going back a few years, I got a small number of abductees, and I put it to them. Bear in mind, these are people that's you know, had this experience, not me. And I asked them that very same question. What do you think has happened to you? Was it E.T.? You know, was it extraterrestrials from, you know, wherever? Getting here, however, you know, another dimension, spaceships, whatever you want to call it. Was it some kind of spiritual experience? Was it some kind of psychological experience? A couple said, definitely, I believe this was, you know, beings from another world. There were a couple of ladies who said, no, Philip, you know, I think this was, to me, some kind of spiritual experience. It awakened things in me. It was like an awakening. And but the others, Martin, just kind of scratched their heads and said, look, Philip, I really don't know. I have no idea what the nature and the origin of these experiences were. All I can tell you is what happened, what I remember. And I put to one gentleman, it's a case from back in the late 1970s here in the UK. It's called John Day. And I said to John, was this a real physical, you know, nuts and bolts experience? And he said, Philip, you know, not only can I not put it into words, but we as a species don't have the vocabulary to describe this experience. He says, but the best way I can explain it is if you went to a movie set, you can look at it, you can touch it, you can feel it, it's solid. But you look behind it and it's just an illusion. And he left it at that. So you can read into that what you want, Martin. Because, you know, I still try and figure that out myself. And it's a few years since I interviewed John Day. So on one hand, it is a physical thing. But on the other hand, it's some kind of illusion, camouflage, call it what you will. And I thanked John for that. And, you know, he's left me scratching my head for many years afterwards with that comment. So even the abductees themselves are not entirely sure, John, Martin, so, and John Day especially. So, you know, I'm not going to hazard a guess. I really am.
You probably know this, but Denise Stoner and Kathleen Martin wrote a book, and they also, in that book, has a list of commonalities. Have you ever looked through the people you've interviewed to see what was common in their stories?
I think one of the commonalities we did come across, didn't really have to look that hard, and it was a kind of not so much with the experiences itself. I mean, Dr. Thomas Bullard noticed the commonalities many, many years back in a study he did. Thomas Bullard was he's a doctor of folklore, I believe. So he noticed there was sort of repeating patterns within the abduction experiences. The same patterns weren't in everyone, but there was commonalities across the board, irrespective of where it was, which country it was, and so on. But one of the things that kept getting reported to myself here was a kind of a byproduct, if you want, Martin. And it was an artistic byproduct. For example, I mentioned John Day. John Day was a what we call a chippy. He was a woodworker, you know, a house builder. Hmm. But him and his wife became interested after, as a direct result of his encounter, they became interested in all kinds of green issues, which back in the 70s weren't really a big thing. Hmm. But his skills as a joiner seemed to change and took a more artistic route. And when I interviewed John, he was making the most beautiful dolls' houses. I mean, they were an absolute work of art. And another young man that I interviewed in Wales, and again, he was a young guy when this happened. I think he was only about 18 when the encounter happened. And, you know, he liked his denim jacket, his long hair, and his rock music. And he says, Philip, he says, after this encounter, he says, please don't tell any of my friends. I started writing poetry. Hmm. And he said, I would be at work. He managed to find a job at a local hotel. He says, you know, I'll pick up a napkin in the hotel and I have to write this poetry down. And it was the poetry was all, again, related back to his encounter, but with a sort of a green issue attached to it, and so on. And another lady, she's sadly no longer with us, called Elsie Elkinson, she became interested in sort of spiritual healing. And again, she puts it as a direct result as back to when she had the encounter. And Elsie was one of those that took the positives out of the experience. And, you know, she became a spiritual healer, having no previous interest in anything like this at all, Martin. So it didn't happen to everyone. You know, let's be fair. And same with the commonalities. They don't happen to everyone, but there seemed to be a little theme here, like green issues or artistic issues that were either enhanced from what they previously had or, you know, just came out of the blue. You didn't have them to begin with, and hey, presto, as a direct result of this, I can now do this, or I'm interested in this, or I'll try this. Well, what that means, what it doesn't mean, your guess is as good as mine, Martin, but it's certainly intriguing.
Absolutely. A lot of times you hear about repeat abductions. Is that the case over there as well? A lot of them are?
Oh, indeed, Martin. Yes. I mean, I mentioned a lady called Jane there. Jane's encounters started at the age of 16 and were ongoing. I mean, you know, and I didn't know Jane when she was 16. I met her many years later. And things would happen, you know, on a regular basis. And I was fortunate she didn't live too far from where I did, so she would, you know, ring me up and I was able to go and document them. She had some physical after effects, if you like, some scratches and things like this about her person. And as far as I'm aware, I mean, I've moved away from that area now. As far as I'm aware, they may be ongoing. I really don't know. But Jane was able to come to terms with them, you know, and say, well, you know, whatever this is, it's not doing me any real physical harm. I can't prevent it. I can't stop it. So I'm going to run with it. I'm going to live with it. And you know, that was a way of her, you know, dealing with it. On the other hand, Martin, there are those that's just a complete one-off. This happened. It was a bolt from the blue. I don't really want it to happen again. I don't know what it was. I mentioned the young man down in Wales, for example. And, I mean, it really terrified him, Martin. And I mean that word. You know, he didn't have any hypnosis. He remembered every single word of it. And he was petrified. And I went back and interviewed him a couple of years after the event. And we sat outside the hotel where he was working. And it was a nice summer's day. And we're talking about his friends, his family, his girlfriend. Fine. As soon as we talked about this incident, his whole demeanor changed. He didn't want to talk about it. And I asked him why. And he said, Philip, he said, I had to have hypnotherapy to take away the nightmares about it. So not regressive hypnosis. It frightened him that much he had nightmares about it. And when I eventually wrote the book Without Consent, I sent him a copy, and I think it took him about 5 years before he plucked up enough courage to read it. He would now, you know, married with his own family. But that was a one-off. So, but we do get people like Jane, and it happens time and time again. And, you know, Jane was able to come to terms with it and say, well, you know, it's not really done me any harm. Can't figure it out, but, you know, I'm going to have to live with it. I can't stop it. So there doesn't seem to be a balance between which it is, Martin, whether it's a one-off or it's an ongoing thing. And, but yeah, we do have multiple cases. In the book Once Upon a Missing Time, simply because, you know, of constraints on page size and all that, you know, word count and all this kind of thing, I just made it as a one-off encounter and left it at that. You know, I didn't want to emphasise and repeat. And I think we just made the book too long. However, I've worked with an actor friend of mine called Nabil Shaban here in England, and we've written a screenplay based on the book, and we've just shortened the title to Missing Time. And although in there we still remain that there's just one encounter, the difference, the main one, and the main difference is at the end, when you think it's all over, the encounters start up again, or are just about to start up again. So, you know, we're giving a strong hint that you know, these things are not a one-off, it's ongoing. So it is different in that respect to Once Upon a Missing Time. But like I said, in the work of fiction, I've just kept it at one encounter, and that seems to work well when it comes to writing it down.
Mm-hmm. I know I'm asking for a lot of similarities between the U.S. here and what happens there, but you mentioned false pregnancies. Are a lot of the abduction accounts, do they talk about the genital examination like you hear about? And does anyone ever talk about implants?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, one of the commonalities, if you like, was, and it is, still is, some kind of physical aspect to the encounter, a medical examination, for want of a better word. There aren't a lot of people like Jane who talk about the smart baby dreams and that kind of thing. That's still a rarity. And as far as so-called alien implants are concerned, again, it's I don't think that's as widespread as perhaps you might find it in other parts of the world. But again, I have come across people. In fact, just recently, a lady contacted me about a member of her family who thinks they may have some kind of implant. And she first contacted Dr. Roger Lear in the United States, mm-hmm. who's sort of been a pioneer in this field. And I know Roger very well, and he said, well, I can't do anything from the United States. Perhaps you might like to speak to Philip. And again, I've put this particular lady in touch with somebody. She lives hundreds of miles from where I do, Martin, so I've put her in touch with somebody nearer to where she lives who may be able to assist her. So that's rare, you know, and I don't know any of the intimate details. I know she was just looking for some assistance. There's nothing I can do from where I am at the moment. So it seemed appropriate to get somebody who lived nearer to her. So again, it's not common, but it's not unknown.
Yeah, Dr. Roger Lear is a future guest on our show, and I'm going to really drill him about a question I have about implants, and that is, if they can be removed, isn't that the smoking gun if their technology is whatever these implants are? You know, it's a whole puzzle in itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, in the book Once Upon a Missing Time, we don't directly mention implants, but the subtle hints that there might be something else happening, you know, there are marks about their bodies, which has been reported. Again, I mentioned Jane, you know, she had various marks about her body after certain encounters. So we hint at it, but we don't mention it in your face. What I've tried to do in this story is to let the reader use their own imagination, Martin. I think, you know, I was brought up on that kind of storytelling. So you can read into things like that what you will. And it can also be coincidental, you know. Maybe, you know, he's been at school, he's had a, you know, an argument in the playground with a child, and he's got a scratch that he didn't realise was there. So if you think about, you know, the film Close Encounters, there's a few red herrings in it like that. Perhaps there's an explanation for this. Or perhaps there's not, you know. So you make of it what you will. But going back to sort of real-life cases, I mean, you know, I'm sure Roger will say, yes, it is the smoking gun. And he has no doubt that these are the genuine article. They're not of this earth. He has worked with others in the field, and they've tried to get these analysed here, there and everywhere and have the results of this, but it's not yet in the mainstream. And, you know, I think Roger will, if not already, not just Roger, others like Daryl Sims and one or two others will be looked upon as pioneers in this field. And who knows, you know, where that may lead, Martin. It's something I follow closely.
So going back to your book, what really inspired you to write a book of fiction?
I think the inspiration or the reason for it, Martin, was I still, even to this day, I get annoyed by the skeptics who will, you know, try and emphasize that people who have these experiences, the abductees, as we will call them, are some kind of fruitcake, or they're after attention, or they want to sell their story to the newspapers for money, and so on. But it's been my experience that is not the case. Yes, you may have one or two like that, but it still annoys me tremendously. I know he's no longer with us, but Philip Klass was a prime example of such scenarios. And it's just not true. So the reason for writing a work of fiction was to say, look, this is based on factual material. This is based on my own investigations that I've done down the years. The files are here, some of which have been published previously. But it's to emphasise that we still have a long way to go to finding the answers behind this phenomenon. And I say in the introduction, to the book. If you're looking for answers to the abduction phenomena, you will not find them in this book. That's not what it's about. It's about emphasizing that whatever this phenomena is, it can happen to you, it can happen to me, it can happen to anyone, anytime, any place, anywhere on Earth. And it's just one way of showing that how difficult it can be to cope with it. However, there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is people that can help you, both professional, i.e. in certain, you know, doctors and other areas of specialities, and what I would call semi-professional or amateurs, if you like. That's me, the UFO researcher. There is help. There is understanding. And not only perhaps by sharing these experiences, we will ever expand our knowledge on it. And there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And that's the main point of it. It's just to put the abduction encounter, the experience, in the light I believe it should be viewed in, without any ridicule, without any fun being poked at it. Or there are one or two light-hearted moments in the book. A lot of people deal with trauma in a light-hearted way. It relieves the angst, if you like.
Sure.
And so I try and paint the abduction in a positive light, if that's the right word, and showing that, you know, that it's not all kooks and lunatics, and that there is something behind this phenomenon. There's something tangible there that, as yet, you know, conventional science has failed to get to grips with. And you know, it's a study that is still ongoing, Martin, and it's one that still intrigues me. I've been involved in UFO research for a long time. I make myself sound really old, don't I? But it still intrigues me to this very day. I mean, again, people from all walks of life report these incidents. Professional people, you know, housewives, teachers, police officers, and you name it. And some of them have more to lose than they have to gain by coming forward with these encounters. So I think there's a very important phenomena here. You know, hopefully, you know, this will add to the pool, if you like, that maybe help the understanding of it and see how people can cope with it. Who knows? I'm just a humble UFO researcher, Martin, and I'm just trying to do my best.
Well, I appreciate your work. And your website is beyondroswell.com. And you can find the book at richarddolanpress.com. Thanks so much, Philip. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you again.
The pleasure's all mine, Martin. Thank you very much.
So that's it for our show today. Thank you for listening. Also, please don't forget to write us a review in iTunes. We could really use your help. And if you can support us financially, we have our subscribe button right on the side of our website. And if you can help us out, that's great. Music is provided by Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse. Thank you, Carrie. That's CarrieLloydWhitehouse.com. Don't forget the Experiencers Speak, which is very similar to this podcast in abduction experiences. That's going on in Portland, Maine, September 6th through the 8th. Hope to see you there. It'd be fun to hang with you. We'll be back next week. And remember, keep your eyes to the sky.